يا الله يا رب العالمين، يا رحمن يا رحيم، يا ربي لدي أمة رازك.
يا الله
يا رب العالمين، يا رحمن يا رحيم، يا ربي لدي أمة رازك. Let us see daylight again once again. Let's become.
European News Bulletin.
Hi there, welcome back. I'm Saeed Pourreza. World leaders at the G7 summit have pledged millions of doses of the COVID-19 vaccine to poorer countries, a promise slammed as just another publicity stunt. Vaccine rollouts in the world's top economies are in overdrive, but it might take years for poorer nations to get their share. Campaigners say they want hard facts on how many doses are to be delivered and when.
The scramble for vaccines has exposed global inequality yet again. Rich economies, including the US, EU, and the UK, have collectively secured more than double the amount they need, 3 billion doses, and administered 75% of the vaccines actually in existence. But in dozens of countries, no one has been vaccinated.
We are more than a little bit concerned that there is or is to be hoarding and price gouging, as well as undue preference in some quarters. This being so, we at CARICOM have recently called upon WHO to immediately convene an international convention of the world's people's representatives to commiserate, explain, assist, and commit to a fair sharing of the available vaccine resources for the benefit of all humankind, and not just the privileged, well-heeled few.
Accused of hoarding, world leaders at the G7 summit Friday tried to stave off criticism by making more pledges. The UK has boasted about leading the world out of the pandemic, but Boris Johnson says the UK comes first, and spare doses will only be given away once all British adults have got the jab. The projection for that is July. US President Joe Biden also used the G7 summit, his first international meeting, to redeem Washington's reputation as the largest contributor to organizations like the World Health Organization. Geopolitics is at play here. Russia and China have emerged as major vaccine suppliers, but the EU has been accused of failing to execute a fair and even rollout, forcing nations to look elsewhere for supplies. China and Russia have already shipped tens of thousands of doses of their COVID-19 vaccine to developing and underdeveloped countries as well. Meanwhile, the US has stopped short of donating from its own massive supply. Amnesty International says rich countries do themselves no favors by hoarding. In the end, if not enough people are immunized, the virus will have free range to mutate and outsmart the vaccines. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Dr. Bob Gill is the producer of The Great NHS Heist, joining me now with his take on that story. So these Western nations have been accused of hoarding vaccines to the detriment of the world's poor. What do you think, what do you make of these accusations? Good evening.
Good evening. Yes, I think there is some value and justification for the accusations. The Western democracies, the UK, the US, are more interested in getting political points out of vaccinating their populations and trying to make amends for their catastrophic handling of the pandemic to date. But as your piece pointed out, this is very short-sighted. And the problems are, again, because their governments are very closely aligned to what's in the interest of the big companies, the pharmaceutical companies that are producing the vaccines. And, you know, rather than giving up supply, what they need to do is address the commercial interests, which are locking in patents and intellectual property rights, which prevent other countries from producing their own vaccines.
Right. The argument, Dr. Gill, is that we're not going to be safe until and unless we're all safe. But these countries do not seem to be listening to that. And that leads to risks being involved to these richer countries around the world who have vaccinated their populations. And the developing world will have to wait until they get these vaccines for their populations.
Yeah, it's very short-sighted. So, you know, the longer you delay the whole world getting vaccinated, and that includes populations in poorer countries, the more chance you have for mutations to occur and for those mutations to be resistant to the vaccine. So you end up undoing the good work within your own country if the unvaccinated and infected people are allowed to travel freely into the UK or the US. So it is short-sighted, and it's in everybody's interest to roll out the vaccine as quick as possible.
Right. Let's talk about two other countries that have come up with the vaccines, Russia and China. They have supplied jabs to developing nations. Do you think they're getting enough credit for this?
I don't think on Western media this will be reported widely, because it does show the Western countries in a bad light. They've been more interested, as I said earlier, to maintain positive political headlines and kudos from rolling out their own vaccine programs. But as we've said, this is short-sighted. And those countries that have been more enlightened and can see that this is ultimately in their own interests, like Russia and like China, they have wielded soft power in a very sensible manner and for the good of humanity.
Right. Dr. Bob Gill, the producer of the great NHS heist. Thank you so much. The UK Foreign Secretary has said European countries welcome Washington's intention to return to diplomacy with Iran and rejoin new JCPOA talks. Dominic Raab and his European counterparts held a meeting in Paris Thursday to discuss how to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The Trump administration unilaterally pulled out of the agreement in 2018, you recall. But earlier today, President Biden reversed two measures adopted by his predecessor against Iran in an apparent move towards diplomatic talks. Iran maintains that all sanctions against the country should be lifted before it returns to full compliance with the accord. To France, the country has been rocked by a series of sex abuse allegations against the country's top politicians, scholars, and commentators. The allegations first broke out last month with the publication of a book which accused prominent commentator Olivier Duhamel of abusing a child. Mr. Duhamel, a former member of the European Parliament, has since resigned from his position at top French university Sciences Po. President Emmanuel Macron has pledged to tighten France's anti-pedophilia laws. To other news now, the Palestinian Authority has recently announced that parliamentary and presidential elections will be held this year. But Robert Enlakesh argues that serious thought must be given to how the elections can be protected to avoid interference by the U.S. and Israel, among others.
The president of the Palestinian Authority, based in the occupied West Bank, announced in mid-January that Palestine would hold its first parliamentary and presidential elections in 15 years. But will Israel, the United States, and others allow a free and fair election, or will they intervene as they did in the past? The announcement that the first Palestinian elections in 15 years would take place this year has since caused many to fear a potential backlash due to both party divides and foreign interference. The last elections held in Palestine took place in 2006, in which Hamas was democratically elected. What later ensued was a bloody civil war-type conflict between Hamas and their rivals Fatah. Ultimately, the Palestinian Authority, which had since the Oslo Accords presided over both the Gaza Strip and West Bank, were forced out of Gaza after an attempted coup was foiled by Hamas's armed wing. The divide between Fatah and Hamas has never been fully repaired, leading many Palestinians to question whether there will even be elections later this year. So many questions also remain unanswered about exactly how it will work and who will participate, with analysts suspecting that Mahmoud Abbas, Palestinian Authority president, announced the decision only in order to please the newly U.S.-elected president, Joe Biden. Another concerning sign of things to come are the emerging reports from the West Bank that Hamas officials have been warned by Israel not to take part in the upcoming elections. So, what happened last time during the elections? Despite the fact that Jimmy Carter had called the 2006 Palestinian elections completely fair and honest, the results were rejected by Israel, the United States, and others in the West. Instead of recognizing the democratic election results, the West began to slap onto Gaza some of the most draconian sanctions the world had seen. Ultimately, the people of Gaza were punished by the United States for simply casting their votes. But even prior to the Palestinian elections, which the United States had pushed for, intelligence agencies had been revealed to have acted to undermine the course of Palestinian democracy. It was revealed in what are now known as the Palestine Papers that a 2004 seven-page Palestinian security plan was written by British intelligence officials and had outlined a plan to actively undermine Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa Brigades. The fact that the MI6 were revealed to have actively worked to undermine Palestinian political parties is a cause for great concern and has led to speculation that such things could again occur. It is clear that Israel would definitely oppose a Hamas win in the West Bank. If it was to occur, we could end up seeing a massive escalation of violence or even clashes between the PA and Hamas. In 2006, the PA refused to work with Hamas and became the partner of the US and Israel to attempt to oust Hamas from power. In November 2006, Lieutenant General Keith Dayton, US-appointed security coordinator for the Palestinians, had met with PA strongman Mohammed Dahlan, reportedly promising the PA $86.4 million in order to build up their forces to take on Hamas. WikiLeaks cables uncovered that in 2007, Israel's military intelligence director, Amos Yadlin, had backed the idea of aid to Fatah in order to depose Hamas. Yadlin had even stated that it was fine, even if it meant Gaza would be completely controlled by Hamas as a result, qualifying his support by saying that if Hamas took over, Israel could then simply justify making the coastal enclave a no-go zone. Also, a 45-minute tape released by The Observer in 2016 revealed that Hillary Clinton had stated the following in 2006, that we, the United States, should have made sure that we did something to determine who was going to win, end quote. With such a statement having been made about an intention to openly conspire to rig a foreign election, this raises real concerns that the US could be considering such a move this time. In a time where the issue of election rigging is so prominent, the question of the historical interference in Palestinian democratic processes should be an item up for discussion. If such interference was to lead to the brutal siege on Gaza, a bloody US-backed coup attempt, civil war, and pushed peace further away, then this election should ideally be protected at all costs to avert further harm.
Robert Ernlakesh. The European Commissioner for Home Affairs has visited a refugee camp in Bosnia, home to about 1,000 people living in horrendous conditions.
I wanted to come here personally to visit the camp, to meet with migrants, to meet with the people who work here from the UN organizations, from the Bosnia-Herzegovina authorities and the local authorities, to see with my own eyes and hear their own voices. Because I was very concerned about the humanitarian crisis in December, right in the middle of the winter, with the lack of the Bira camp and the closing of the Lipa camp.
The makeshift camp used to have no running water or any medical supplies. Cases of scabies and other sanitation illnesses began to spread before the camp was gutted by a fire in December, leaving around 1,000 people without shelter. Germany's top security official has said about 10,000 people attempting to enter the country at the Czech and Austrian borders have been turned away since strict controls were introduced on Sunday. The restrictions were introduced in a bid to reduce the spread of more contagious coronavirus variants. Entry to the country is now restricted to German citizens, residents, medical workers, and truck drivers, all of whom need to show a recent negative coronavirus test. China has blasted the UK and its media for, quote, concocting and spreading rumors, lies, and false information on China-related issues. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying reminded British journalists that it is imperative they remain truthful and objective in their reporting of issues relating to the UK and China. This comes only 2 weeks after London controversially banned China's CGTN network from broadcasting in the United Kingdom, resulting in Beijing taking reciprocal action by banning BBC World News from airing in China. We'll be right back.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Two stories to cover in this segment. Only 24 hours after we brought you an update on the death of a black man in Wales, soon after he had left police custody, we have now news of another black man dying at the hands of Welsh police. For all the details of that story, let's bring in Richard Sudan. Richard, it's really bizarre that it's only 24 hours later and another black man has been found dead only after he had contact with the police.
Yes, indeed, Saeed. Another black man dead following, you know, custody and contact with Welsh police in deeply troubling and suspicious circumstances. We're going to talk today about the case of Moid Bashir, age 29, who we're learning died on Wednesday morning following being restrained by the police. Now, what's really disturbing about this case is this is actually an instance where the young man's parents actually called the police because Moed was having a mental health episode, and they actually realized that he needed to go back to hospital, and so they called police really to get some assistance in that regard. And we're hearing reports that they expected maybe two or three police officers to turn up to assist, and actually what we're hearing is 24 police officers turned up, forced their way into the young man's room. Now, to be clear, this young man was not under arrest, but apparently he was handcuffed. Apparently his legs were restrained. He was held face down on the floor, utterly traumatizing his parents. And then what happened was there was an existing leg wound which was reopened, and this young man basically bled to death as a result of this now fatal contact with the police. We're talking about Moid Bashir here, but yesterday we talked about Mahmoud Hassan, who actually died following contact with the police in early January. And so this raises a number of questions. The first one is regarding the case we're talking about today, Mr. Bashir. Would the police have treated him in this manner if, say, for example, he was a young white woman? It's very doubtful. And a lot of people would say the reason for that doubt is because the police are institutionally racist. They would also say, many people, many critics, that the police are simply not fit to deal with mental health crises. To a lot of people, the police are like a hammer, and they say that every problem looks to them like a nail. And so invariably, the police watchdog, the IOPC, or whatever they call themselves this week, has, you know, basically referred themselves to be investigated. But a lot of people have no faith in the police watchdog carrying out any real impartial investigation, because usually these organizations, or this organization, is made up of ex-police officers, etc. So this story is literally breaking as we speak. It's going to be developing. You're going to see a lot more news stations pick up on this, but probably not enough. But for now, you know, the spotlight is firmly on the Welsh police. The families of both of these young men, Moeed Bashir and Mahmoud Hassan, they want answers, they want justice. They want to know exactly what were the circumstances that led to the death of their loved ones, and more importantly, what's going to be done about it and how is justice going to be brought.
Two things here, Richard. One, Moeed Bashir, his family says, was struggling with mental health issues, and also that he had survived a knife attack and was recovering, hence the reason he bled to death after he was shackled by the police. And apparently police were literally on him when that was happening. And also you mentioned the racial element into this incident, the fact that he was treated the way he was. But let us hear some of the views online that people have shared on this story.
And there will be a lot more views in the coming days. I suspect there's two very pertinent reactions from POC4, which I think we should flag up, the first of which reads, "The case of Moeed Bashir will be no different from the many hundreds that have gone before it, and justice remains as elusive today as it has been for the last 40 years. And the second reaction says, "Our first and most urgent demand must be that the IOPC immediately release all of the police body footage in both of the instances we've discussed. Has not yet been released, Saeed." And a lot of people said with the case today, this young man needed medical attention. He didn't need 24 officers manhandling him to the floor.
All right, Richard. Let's go all the way to Spain and the ongoing protests there since the arrest of rapper Pablo Hasél. Tell us what the state of play is, where things stand now.
Well, there have been disturbances in the street, and we're expecting more. Violent protests have erupted in Madrid and Catalonia and Barcelona over the rapper Pablo Hasél's arrest. Now, what has happened so far? We know that Pablo Hasél is a very outspoken activist and artist as well as a rapper, and he's basically began a custodial sentence for criticizing the monarchy and purportedly professing support for groups which have been outlawed as terrorist groups in Spain, Grupo ETA and the Red Army faction. And now he may possibly be facing a longer sentence than the initial one after his appeal has turned down. Now, you've got supporters of Hasél in the streets basically saying, look, this is actually a wider debate about the limits of free speech in Spain, the ability, the freedom to be critical of the monarchy and also critical of the police and police repression. A lot of people are saying, you know, this is one of the kind of more significant cases of someone, you know, basically being arrested literally over freedom of speech. And so this has kind of really morphed into a wider debate, not really
and
about
Richard, what the protesters are also demanding is the so-called gag law, or the citizen safety law, as it is officially known, to be scrapped. And this came into effect years ago, and with the coming to power of the incumbent government, who promised to get rid of it, they haven't done it. And they are pushing for the government to do that, to meet their demand, because they think this government is their last chance to make that happen, and if not, the law is going to stay in place.
Precisely, and actually there's a wariness about not just the existing limits of free speech, according to critics, but the fact that there may be potentially more gagging, more restraint, more limits of free speech down the line. But we can't get away from the fact the issue is also casting a spotlight on, you know, police actions in Spain. I had I saw for myself the police certainly can be repressive in Spain. I was there for the Catalan independence referendum a few years back, and whatever side of the political debate you were on, there was certainly arguably police violence taking place. We've seen over the last few days roughly 100 injuries have taken place. There's reports of one woman actually blinded in the clashes, and I think these clashes are going to continue, certainly, Saeed, over the next few days and possibly longer.
And they speak to the extent of the Spanish state's tolerance for freedom of speech. Tell us what the online netizens have been saying about this.
Let's go first to Joseph, who says, "This is a really dangerous situation that should be monitored by the international community. A young woman already lost her eye due to phone bullet fired by the police during demonstrations. Pro-rapper Pablo Hasél in Barcelona on Tuesday. This is of serious gravity." ANC England says, "Spain has jailed a British citizen without bail for flight risk for protesting against the jailing of a rapper." And Manny says, This gentleman sought refuge in university due to reasons of free speech against the monarchy and the police and has now been jailed. Note to self, universities are not safe spaces, and highlights the fact Podemos leadership have called for the release of Pablo Hasél.
All right, Richard Sedan with those stories. Richard, thank you very much. And thank you. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
At least 58 people died in storm-affected areas stretching from Texas to Ohio. Victims of carbon monoxide poisoning, car crashes, drownings, house fires, and hypothermia. Carol Anderson spent much of his life in southeast Texas, where the most feared natural disasters spin up from the Gulf of Mexico during the warm months of hurricane season. But last week, Mr. Anderson, a 75-year-old who breathed with the help of oxygen tanks, knew that a different kind of storm was heading his way. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Julia McDonnell Nieto del Rio, Richard Fawcett, and Johnny Diaz. The piece is titled, Extreme Cold Killed Texans in Their Bedrooms, Vehicles, and Backyards. Stay with us for more of Julia McDonnell Nieto del Rio, Richard Fawcett, and Johnny Diaz's article. At least 58 people died in storm-affected areas stretching from Texas to Ohio. Victims of carbon monoxide poisoning, car crashes, drownings, house fires, and hypothermia. Carol Anderson spent much of his life in southeast Texas, where the most feared natural disasters spin up from the Gulf of Mexico during the warm months of the hurricane season. But last week, Mr. Anderson, a 75-year-old, who breathed with the help of oxygen tanks, knew that a different kind of storm was heading his way. To prepare, he ordered a fresh supply of oxygen that his stepdaughter said never arrived. There was a spare tank, however, in the pickup truck outside his one-story brick house in Crosby, Texas, just northeast of Houston. So when Mr. Anderson, an Army veteran who went by the name of Andy, was found dead inside his truck on Tuesday, 16th of February, his stepdaughter figured that he had gone outside to retrieve the oxygen tank. His main tank back in the house runs on electricity, and the power had gone out the night before as a deadly cold descended on much of Texas. While the final tally could be much higher, Mr. Anderson was among at least 58 people who died in storm-affected areas stretching from Texas to Ohio. Victims of carbon monoxide poisoning, car crashes, drownings, house fires, and hypothermia. In Galveston County, along the Texas Gulf Coast, the authorities said two residents had died from exposure to the cold, and one person from possible carbon monoxide poisoning. Four other deaths remained under investigation and were possibly linked to the frigid Arctic weather. Judge Mark Henry, the country's top elected official, said he would have evacuated some of his most vulnerable residents in advance of the winter storm had he known that the power outages would plunge the county into darkness for a few days. He said the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which manages the state's power grid, had warned only of rolling blackouts. Instead, most Texas residents were without power for at least 48 hours. "We would have been happy to order an evacuation if we'd been told Sunday that the power was going to go out and stay out for 4 days," he said, noting that the county is more accustomed to ordering evacuations in advance of hurricanes. A spokeswoman for ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, said on Friday, 19th of February, that the surge in demand stressed the power grid, a crisis so dire that the local utilities were not able to rotate the power outages. At its height, about 4 million Texans were without power this week as temperatures plummeted to the teens and single digits. About 165,000 remained without electricity on Friday, 19th of February 2021, though millions were still without running water or under notices to boil their tap water. Still, there were signs of relief. In hard-hit Austin, city manager Spencer Kronk said on Friday that more than 1 million gallons of water would arrive over the next 2 days. The city plans to set up distribution centers, and city manager Spencer Kronk said water will be delivered to the city's most vulnerable citizens, such as older people and those without homes. Greg Mazaros, the director of Austin's water utility, said he expected that most residents would have their water pressure restored over the weekend. Boil water advisories should be lifted sometime next week, he said. "Coming into clearer view were the dimensions of a public health crisis exacerbated by poverty, desperation, and in some cases a lack of understanding of cold weather safety. Texas hospitals and health providers saw more than 700 visits related to carbon monoxide poisoning between Monday 15th and Wednesday 17th of February. Thayer Smith, division chief with the Austin Fire Department, said his city had seen dozens of incidents of toxic exposure from people burning charcoal in their homes. The weather also hampered the response to the coronavirus pandemic. The White House on Friday said 6 million doses of coronavirus vaccines had been held up because of snowstorms across the country, creating a backlog affecting every state and throwing off the pace of vaccination appointments over the next week. In Texas, hospitals spent a week grappling with the burst pipes, power outages, and acute water shortages, making it difficult to care for patients. In Abilene, Texas, authorities said a man died at the Hendrick Medical Center after he was unable to get dialysis treatment at the site. Large amounts of filtered water, in addition to electricity and heat, are required to properly provide care for dialysis patients. And water at the hospital was shut down, according to Candy Flores, the Abilene fire chief. Fire Chief Flores said that at least 4 people had died in Abilene as a result of the state power grid failure, including a homeless man who died from exposure to the cold, a 60-year-old man who was found dead in his home, and an 86-year-old woman whose daughter found her frozen in her backyard. Elsewhere in the state of Texas, a 69-year-old man was found dead inside his home in a rural community south of San Antonio, where he lived alone. He did not have electricity, and the authorities said his bedroom was 35 degrees when they found him. In Houston, Texas, an Ethiopian immigrant died in her idling car, which was parked in her garage where she sat whilst charging her mobile phone. She was talking to a friend when she started to feel tired. She tried to drink water, said Nagash Desta, a relative by marriage to Etanesh Mersha, who died. After she told her friend she couldn't talk anymore, there was no response after that. The friend tried to call the police in Houston, but did not have an address, Mr. Desta said. The friend turned to Facebook, where she found Mr. Desta. Hours later, he eventually received a message about what had happened and alerted the police. They found an entire family poisoned by carbon monoxide. When they get in, they found the mother and daughter were just dead and the son and father alive. They had all fainted, he said, adding that the car had still been running. The daughter, Rakeb Shamilemu, was just 7 years old. Ms. Mersha's husband and 8-year-old son were hospitalized. Mr. Desta said that the husband has since been released, and the 8-year-old boy, Bamnet Shalemu, was still in the intensive care unit. Near Houston, in Conroe, Texas, an 11-year-old boy, Christian Pineda, was found dead in his bed on Monday morning. His family had no electricity the night before, and the parents, the boy and his siblings, had huddled together in just one bedroom. Lieutenant James Kellerman of the Conroe Police Department said on Friday, like Mr. Anderson and Ms. Mersha and her family, Christian Pineda was the focus of a hastily assembled GoFundMe page. If requested donations to cover the expenses of his burial in Honduras, where his family is from. It had raised more than $38,000 as of Friday afternoon. The page showed a picture of a boy in a thin red hoodie smiling and standing in the snow. On Tuesday, 16th of February, whilst Mr. Anderson's wife was mopping up their living room after a frozen pipe burst, he walked to the garage to try to get a generator going, hoping he could help clean up with a shop rack. His wife would not know until later that he had walked to his truck, pickup truck, in search of oxygen, said his stepdaughter, Brandy Campanile. It was 19 degrees. His spare oxygen tank, it would turn out, was actually empty. He was trying to get oxygen and it was just a losing battle, Ms. Campanile said on Friday, 19th of February. Texas is not meant to handle freezing temperatures. It's not something that happens out here.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what are the hidden blessings and divine blessings of the congregational prayers, the Salatul Jama'at, as far as our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah, is concerned? So, dear listeners, we're talking about the blessings and the divine blessings and these beautiful hidden things which are within congregational prayers and how they help and elevate and strengthen our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah. One of the beautiful things that we find in congregational prayers is that, yes, we can enhance our ubudiyah, we can enhance our servitude of Allah,
via these congregational prayers, not just on an individual level, but we can do this on a collective level as well. It's very beautiful, but this congregational prayer is almost like the Hajj, where all of these people from all different parts of the world come together and they perform this servitude of Allah, this obedience and ubudiyah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in a collective manner. But in this collective manner, I need to remind you that the individual is not lost. And that is the beauty of Islam, where the individual remains an individual, but as a collective becomes a collective while keeping that individuality in place. Now, it is because of all these different effects that congregational prayers has, of course, which we have talked about in various different sessions and programs of ours. And it is because of all these different effects that the congregational prayers have been emphasized to such a great degree. Now, of course, they are not wajib, they're not obligatory, but they have been very, very highly recommended. And if we want to take that extra step in order to elevate our ubudiyah, then these congregational prayers are definitely that excellent step to take.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to this segment of the program, Foresight. My name is Muhammad, and today I'd like to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatul Mutawassilin, the whispered prayer seeking mediation. Please stay with me. My God, I have no mediation with you but the tender acts of your clemency, nor any way to come to you but the gentle favors of your mercy and the intercession of your Prophet, the Prophet of Mercy, who rescued the community from confusion. Make these two my tie to attaining your forgiveness, and let them take me to triumph through your good pleasure. My hope has dismounted in the sacred precinct of your generosity. My craving has alighted in the courtyard of your munificence. So actualize my expectation from you. Seal my works with good and place me among your selected friends, those whom you have set down in the midst of your garden and settled in the abode of your honor, whose eyes you have gladdened by gazing upon you on the day of meeting you, and whom you have made heirs to the sure stations in your neighborhood.
Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were talking about. As far as the congregational prayers, their divine blessings, and how it can impact and be effectful upon our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. Now, of course, we had talked about these beautiful effects that the congregational prayer has, such as strengthening brotherhood, such as increasing our individual ubudiyah, and also creating and manifesting a collective ubudiyah, servitude of Allah, and how it is a great place the congregational prayers for us to be able to get to know each other, to remove resentments, to remove suspicions, to increase the bonds of community and fraternity and brotherhood and family, and of course how it helps us to increase our knowledge, our sincerity, our humbleness, and truly a whole long list of beautiful blessings that the congregational prayers have as far as our ubudiya is concerned. And of course it is because of all these things that we find that the congregational prayers are so much highly emphasized. Now, some of us might think, no, that doesn't really make sense. Why would the congregational prayers be emphasized? Or where has the congregational prayers been emphasized? Well, we see that in these Book of Traditions by the name of Wasail al-Shia, in volume number 5, page number 377, we find a beautiful tradition regarding the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. In this tradition, it is found that even when a blind man requested exemption from going to the mosque to attend congregational prayers, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, said, "Tie a rope from your house to the mosque, and with its help, you will be able to arrive at the mosque and return home afterwards." Allahu Akbar. And so in another tradition, we also find that the Messenger of Allah would not even permit blind men to abandon the congregational prayers. Of course, here we find how important these congregational prayers are, that even people who cannot see, people who are blind, are still encouraged to come to the congregational prayers.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Nami Farhat Al-Amali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In this life, we face many problems. We go through different trials. And as believers, the first thing we search for when we go through a problem is the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. How can we receive the mercy of Allah? The answer is in the Quran. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in chapter 7, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَإِذَا قُرِئَ الْقُرْآنُ فَاسْتَمِعُوا لَهُ وَأَنصِتُوا لَعَلَّكُمْ تُرْحَمُونَ. And when the Quran is recited, then listen to it and remain silent, that mercy may be shown to you. Listen to the Quran. Reflect on the verses of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Read the Quran and have the intention in your heart that Allah is speaking to you directly. It is mentioned that Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, every time he used to read a verse saying, Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, he used to say, Sami'na wa ata'na. We listened and we obeyed. It is like he used to see that Allah Azza wa Jalla is speaking to him directly in the Quran. Try to at least read one page of the Quran every day, and you will start to feel how your life is going to change. You will start to feel the peace in your life. Even if you are going through a lot of problems, even if you are left alone, you wouldn't feel lonely. Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, he says, if everyone from the east to the west was to die, if everyone in this life was to die, and I had the Quran with me, I wouldn't feel lonely. Hold on to the book of Allah and reflect on its verses. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you on the program. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we were talking about how these congregational prayers are so important and they have so many beautiful and divine blessings and positive effects for the Muslim brothers and sisters when they go and they do these congregational prayers. Of course, we had talked about how highly recommended these congregational prayers are. And we also talked about how the Holy Prophet said that even if you need to tie a rope from your house to the mosque because you are blind, that you should do so. Now, of course, in today's age and time, people live far away from the mosque. And in this situation, of course, you can't tie a rope from your house to the masjid. But if we think and reflect a little bit about the importance, this means that there should be people in the community that take up the responsibility to take those people who aren't able to go by themselves to the mosque. Meaning there are some people who should take the elderly who perhaps can't drive to the masjid, to the mosque, and they must take up this responsibility and take these people to the masjid and the mosque and acquire the divine rewards set for this action by Allah. And of course, receive the blessings of this kind of ubudiyah as well. And so just to try to conclude, because unfortunately we don't have much time left on our program, this is a very important point that, you know, we should help each other in going to the congregational prayers, whether it is encouraging our brothers, our sisters in the community, whether it's encouraging our family members to go to the congregational prayers, and really to see, you know, if there are people in the community who aren't able to go by themselves, we should really come forth and help these people to go to the congregational prayers as much as we can. Of course, you know, sometimes the circumstances of the environment might not allow us to be able to go to congregational prayers. It might not be safe. It might not be appropriate because of the conditions that are prevalent for us to be able to go to congregational prayers. One thing that we have always said on the program and in previous programs is that we can even conduct congregational prayers at home with our families, with our parents, with our brothers and sisters. There's nothing wrong with doing congregational prayers. And matter of fact, in today's age and time where the conditions are not very good, which allows us to go to the masjid, to the mosque as often as we would like, it is very possible and it is recommended. Go ahead and do the congregational prayers at home with each other, and may Allah give you the rewards of this ubudiyah, just as if you were to go to the masjid and the mosque on regular days. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.